In our continuing series on expat groups in Belgium, the Bulletin talks to Dominic Newsted, the chaplain of St. Paul's Anglican Church in Tervuren since July 2020. He reflects on the challenges of ministering to a multicultural community during confinement and how his experience abroad has given him a unique perspective on local and international issues.
So Dominic, you arrived in Belgium in the summer of 2020. How did you adapt to starting a new job in the middle of a pandemic?
I think it was quite challenging, partly because the pandemic meant that we couldn't all of us move. So we had a little bit of adjustment in our family life as to who came and who had to stay in the early months. Clearly, we weren't able to gather together as a whole church because there were restrictions there, which means that many people in the community, in the church family that we would meet, we just were not able to meet, which was kind of really sad. There was lots of things that we had planned, lots of things that we were hoping to be able to do, both as a church community and as a family, that we were not able to do. I think the hardest thing has been ministering to people that I've not had a chance to sit in their garden and chat to about their hopes and dreams. It's just very, very different how you would be talking to people in real life than how you talk to them over Zoom and all those kinds of things. So I feel as if it's been challenging because it's a year when people have had a lot to go through, but the way in which you can meet and share and support has almost been at arm's length. So that's been, I think, the really hard thing to do. And I think, like a lot of expat communities where support networks are not nearby, and therefore people are having to build that support network in the community. At a time when you're isolated, you feel very, very far from the people that you know and love and that can care for you. And just how difficult that's been coming into that and not being able to establish friendships and groups and seeing other people as well arriving, some with small children, some with complex families, and just seeing how difficult that has been, just because I think as humans, we want that human contact. We want to have people around us. We want to be able to make friends and associate with people. So I think it's that isolation has been really, really hard. And obviously church life is about gathering people together. So your whole reason to be together and the way you operate is taken away from you. So that has been a challenge. And it's meant learning lots and lots of new and different ways and finding ways in which we can try and meet people and get to know people and be there for one another.
And how has St. Paul's sort of functioned or adapted its services, for example, over the past 18 months and found ways to interact with its community?
So we've not been able to gather in the school, which has been where we've been for 20 plus years. So that's meant that we've all had to learn lots and lots of new things. We've had to find ways in which we can learn how to use technology well. So we've been doing lots of things, particularly with our children and young people online to begin with. We've invested in technology to be able to live stream, to be able to record, to make sure that people who are isolated, particularly some of our older folk, have still got something which they can see and be part of. We are, as a church, under the kind of the umbrella of the Anglican Central Committee that works with the government, so there is a lot of protocols that need to go through that need to be formally approved by the Minister of Justice about how we can meet. So again, we've had to learn a whole new way of doing risk assessments and all those kinds of things which are necessary to be able to gather people together safely. We've had some fantastic people who've worked on things like for our carol service at Christmas, having different choirs sing different bits so that you can gather only five at a time, and then a team who've then worked with that to be able to put that together, so you get a whole choir experience putting different bands together. So we've just learned technology, learned how to use it to our advantage, and found ways, in a sense, of being able to put something out there digitally, whilst also recognizing that some things we just won't do because it's good to be longing to get back together. And therefore, you know, as a church community, you want to be together. So there are some things we've just said, well, we can't do that, and we can't gather everybody together, so we'll not do it. And we'll feel the pain and live with the pain of not being able to do the things that we want to do. But we'll find new things to do, and we've done as much as we can to connect with people.
And how are you sort of planning, or, you know, future events, or, you know, looking ahead to the autumn? I mean, obviously, as we all know, that's difficult for everybody, not entirely knowing what's around the corner.
So I think we've learned all plans are done in pencil, and we don't even call them plan A, plan B. It's just, well, this is what we think might happen. So we're doing that for September. We, again, because of the COVID restrictions, and we've still not returned back to the school because obviously we don't want to jeopardise, it's not right to jeopardise the schooling of children by going back to the school. So we've been using a church building in Dalesburg. We've used different places. We've done services in the park, which we've been able to do at St Hubertus. Again, we've had to work with all kinds of different authorities to get approval to be able to do that. We've done some wonderful stuff outdoors. And so we're planning on that in September. We've got a different number of events. We've got some where we will be doing things in the church, which is a much more traditional expression of how we can gather. We'll be having some cafe-type services in a restaurant where we can gather people and their children, and we can do that inside. So we're just finding different ways in which we can gather. We're grateful that the church regulations have been linked to the HoReCa sector, so what's possible in a restaurant is possible in a church. We're finding lots of ways of doing hospitality, so that also we've got people in different communities who've been hosting other families in their gardens. Again, we're fortunate that we've got people who are willing to do that, have got the space to do that. We've connected people who are new to maybe one or two other families. And we're just saying, look, we'll do as much as we can, and we'll use what is possible. And then every time more permission is given to do something new, we go back to the drawing board and say, right, we can do this, we can do this, we can do this. And yeah, like lots of people, we're just having to learn to do new things in different ways. And seeing it as a challenge and a joy, rather than harking on to all we can't do. And I think that's, for us, has been important. Let's focus on what we can do. Let's focus on what is possible. Let's focus on things that are going to bring real value to people that we can do. And let's enjoy doing that and do that to the very best of our ability.
Yeah, looking for the positives. Tervuren is a popular place for expats. There's a large international community here. Can you describe the parish and any challenges that it does have?
I think the church community has changed a little bit over time. So I think if you go back 20 years when I visited St Paul's 20 years ago, it was predominantly English-speaking. Predominantly families with their children at the British school. What we've seen, which is a delight actually, is that we see a lot of families, what the French called the foyer mixte, of people from different nationalities who want to be part of an English-speaking church, English-speaking community. We see lots of people, therefore, who have their children in French schools and Dutch schools coming to us. People from many countries in Europe and Africa and Latin America too. So it's, I think, much more varied, much more multicultural. And that brings a real richness to the community here. And it also gives us a lot of insight into, I suppose, different communities' experience of what it means to live internationally. There are also not many interviewers as there would be in Brussels, but there are certainly families who've come, particularly some of our African families, for whom their families at home and their experience of going through COVID and living in areas where you can't isolate in a different bedroom because the family are all, have shared rooms and things like that, for whom it's been a real challenge. And therefore, we've had to be very aware that even within our community and even in the privileged community that Tervuren and the surroundings are, that not everybody comes with the kind of the support and the financial ability to be able to travel, visit family, support family at home. So I think we're mixed. I think we found that in these last few months, there's been a lot of ways in which we can help with some of the charities that we partner with, that it's helped us see a little bit more of where the need is as well, to be able to respond to that, which again has just been a really, really good thing for us as a church to be able to do.
You mentioned charities. What kind of charity work or charities are you involved with?
Oh, now you're asking. So Oasis is one that's got a project, certainly with working amongst some trafficked people in Belgium. We support the Protestant Social Centre, which does a lot of meals and looks out for people who have real needs. So we did something just in the run-up to Christmas called Kindness of Christmas that was linked in with the Scouts and a lot of the schools and a lot of the community, where we became a kind of a, we used our empty building to gather food and gifts and others, which went through partly with some of the social services here in Tervuren, but also with some of those in Brussels to support families for whom there was a real struggle, shortage of food, and worked with them.
Okay, you previously worked in St Albans in the UK, but you've also served abroad. Can you tell me about your career and international experience?
So I think one of the things that drew us here is that I've had, 15 years ministry in churches that meet in schools. So working not in established church buildings, but in communities that are building a community, but without any permanent physical building. So we did that internationally in Fontainebleau, where we were in the early 2000s, where our children were born, establishing a church there that was very new, into a church that was growing, particularly amongst the international community around the business school there and people who worked in the south end of Paris, where a lot of the international companies were. We did the similar thing in Liverpool again, where we worked in a church that met in a school, and just the opportunity it was a school that was in an area that's on the edge of Birkenhead that has real social deprivation, and it was just wonderful being able to be part of a community like that. So I was in a regular English parish in the UK just before coming here, but a lot of my time has been built in those communities where there's no visible presence that people say, oh yes, here it is, we know where the building is. So therefore, community building, gathering people, how are we accessible? How do people know we're here? What value are we bringing to the community? What value are we bringing to the schools where we meet? How can we serve? How can we gather people? And how can we support people that we meet? And particularly too, I think there are so many questions around, who am I? Why am I here? What has life got for me? What is our future? To be able to have that kind of input into those conversations wherever you are, and having those conversations on the streets. In the UK, we used to meet once a week in the pub with some people, having those very same conversations, just saying, look, here we are. Got any questions? Come and chat. And just finding ways of being visible and being a community and being valued in that community, I think, is really important.
You were also involved in missions in Central Africa, is that right? Rwanda and Burundi. What was that about?
So it came about because I was at college with somebody who had lived and worked in Burundi, And he'd said to me, "Dominic, come on, with your French language skills, French East Africa really needs people that can speak French, because there are lots of people who go to Tanzania, Uganda and Kenya, but nobody goes across into Burundi, Rwanda, Congo, because the language is an obstacle." So Annie and I went one summer way back in the early 90s, and we spent a summer in Burundi working for the church there with them, doing what they asked us to do. And I suppose we fell in love a little bit with East Africa, and I ended up on the Council of Rwanda Mission, as it was called then, and we did some, I did some short-term educational things with them. I also led a team shortly after the genocide to do some rebuilding in amongst the youth there. And obviously that's really, really difficult, and it marks you. I know and have met some of the Rwandan community here. It's something that's very difficult to explain, and for people who live there, it's something that they have with them, which they carry. And it's great to be able to talk to other people who've been there and been part of that. And we've continued to have links with that part of the world. We'd hoped at one stage that we would go and live there permanently ourselves. But I think partly because of just some of the concerns post the genocide, that didn't happen. But we've continued to maintain links, continued to support friends there, I spent a sabbatical there as well. Just a part of the country I love that's... It's seen some really, really difficult and harrowing times, but also I think when things are at their darkest, it's also where you see hope and light, and you see bravery, and you see goodness, and you see people at their best. I love going there.
It's a very beautiful place, isn't it? It has a lot going for it now as well.
And the people are lovely, and it's funny, isn't it? Because people talk to you and say, "Oh, you know, how could you go to places like that?" And yeah, it's not stable, you know. And you know, particularly Congo, that eastern part of Congo, which is so rich in minerals, which are just robbed. 80% of the minerals they think from that part of Congo come via illegal trade. That goes into our smartphones and all these other things, and we consume them. But actually, when you're there, the people are just gracious and lovely and welcoming. I have never felt threatened. I know, and I've been with people who've been kidnapped, and it's not great. But I've not experienced that, and it's just wonderful being with people who are so gracious and thankful, even though they have so little. And it just makes us realise, in a sense, how privileged we are. And sometimes, you know, we moan about some of the things that we don't have, and yet, it just helps bring a perspective as to what is important, and to help, I think, me to be on that kind of even keel, because it's very easy to be drawn into a community, isn't it, like Tavuren, and all that there is available to us here in Belgium, and it's great. But it's just good to carry that side of actually, you know, we do have a responsibility, and there are bigger questions, as we've seen at the moment. You know, do you have a third vaccine? Do we actually, as the EU is beginning to do, say, no, actually, we need to be sending vaccines to the developing world. We need to be finding solutions that are whole world solutions, not just what is good for us. And that's great to see. And it's something that, because of the time I've spent there and those connections, and still knowing and being in contact with people there, it's really good to have that as part of who you are, I think.
And you're bilingual, because you also have French nationality, is that right? Your mother's French?
I do, yes. It was one of the questions that was asked, I think, on the interview, or part of the interview process, or shortly afterwards, by one of the French men on the panel who said to me, "Sir Dominic, when it comes to the Six Nations, who are you going to support, France or England?" Knowing full well that I had a French mother, that my grandfather was a French rugby international, and so that I always say I think I'm probably 51% French and 49% British, but there we go.
But it's certainly been a plus in terms of this perspective you've had to international issues and life.
Yes, I think it's been really, really important for us, I suppose, as and for me as identifying as a European and having growing up with two cultures. But also, I think, particularly when we were in Fontainebleau, we were doing a lot of work with teenagers around what they now call third culture kids, and children who grew up with those two cultures who end up living in a third. And of course, I'm doing that, having grown, you know, had English and French. Here I am in Belgium. I know my sister lived in Asia, my brother lived in the States. But you see that particularly with children who are growing up with these multiple cultures, who are never quite sure where they belong, whether I belong here, whether I belong there, who actually end up wanting to travel and go to different places, explore new things. So I think having had that myself, I've always been too English when I'm in France, too French when I'm in England, and not knowing quite where you fit in, I think it's certainly informed a lot of my work, particularly the children and youngsters who are exploring that very thing themselves. You know, who am I? Where do I belong? How do I fit in? What does my future look like?
Yes, because on one hand, they're in a very privileged position. It's a very enriching experience having more than one nationality and knowing more than one language. But it can create this instability and this problems with identity and, as you said, where to call home.
I mean, is it an instability? I mean, it's instability, but also it's a richness that allows them not to be in a culture so much that you have to accept everything at the expense of everything else. And yes, there are times when that's quite hard. I know, my children were really, really struggling with Brexit and that what it means to be English in a country that does that. Because, of course, they've been born overseas, they've lived overseas, and I see that here. Amongst children and particularly young people who just are trying to find out who they are and where they belong, they really value that richness, but it takes a little bit of time to work out how does that richness live out when I'm surrounded by people who maybe don't have that. And so that's great. And, you know, I see it in my own daughter, who's at boarding school in England. Her best friends... None of her best friends are English. They are from, she has one from Namibia, she has some friends from Botswana, some from Bangladesh. And it's just really interesting that she associates really well with others who have that international dimension to their lives.
You also mentioned your previous work with children's projects. Is that a continuing priority for you? And do you have any other particular areas that you focus on as well?
So I think children's work is really important to us. But within children's work, that's also what I would say is caring for the whole family. Because, I mean, I love working with teenagers. Teenagers are a delight if they're not your own. And because they love the fact that you're giving your time for them, and they generally don't have to patrol their boundaries, because that's somebody else's responsibility, that's school and parents. So, you know, I love working with teenagers. I think I've been involved in holiday clubs and beach missions, and I've always led teenage teams in that, because it's part of their leadership development, is part of their growth, taking responsibility. So bringing together, I suppose, children's work, teenage teams, older adults who will mentor the teens while they work with children. I find those specific things around, you know, holiday clubs and children's outreach and the things that you can do are just so good, because although it sounds if you're just doing children's work, actually you're building multi-generational and intergenerational relationships, which is just really good for church life. But it's also really interesting that the Sunday Times a couple of years back did some research on what made the best graduates going into the FTSE 100 companies. And they were slightly horrified to discover that one of the threads that was there in their top candidates was being involved in the church in their teenage years. And they thought, oh, why is that? And they realised that one of those things was that the way our society is now is children talk to children, teenagers talk to teenagers, adults talk to adults, and we're often in our little groups. Where are the places where different generations spend time, are interested in each other, find out about each other, and relate well? And of course, if you can do that through your teen years, then it's so much easier, isn't it, to relate to colleagues, to more senior, your bosses and other things like that. So, but I just love the way in which you see children grow, that you see children you've known then take on leadership and grow and develop in their teenage years. For me, it's the best thing there is, I think.
Of course, COVID has placed, you know, unprecedented stress on individuals and communities, and probably youngsters, you know, more than any other age group. I mean, from your experience as a chaplain, I mean, have you drawn any lessons when helping not just youngsters, but people of all ages and all backgrounds?
I think the really good thing that we've seen this last 18 months, if there can be a good thing, is that it has encouraged people to be much more open about how they're doing. We've seen that with Black Lives Matters, where they've just turned around and said, you know what, this is just not good. We've seen that with mental health, where people are just saying, it's okay to talk about it. And I think, particularly in a community like we have here in Tervuren, where so many are successful and doing well and manage lots of things, that talking about the things they struggle with and things that I can't do, or the things that are deeply personal that I'm not great at, it's just almost taboo. And I think what's happened in the last year to 18 months is that we've seen, and there's been a lot of push for it in lots of different places, but people beginning to talk about how they really are, how they do well, the things that they struggle with, and the things that are damaging to that. Simone Biles, obviously, in the Olympics, has just brought that to a whole different group of people and the awareness of that. But I think for teenagers too, to say, I'm not doing okay, I'm really struggling. There are days when I feel like crying, and for that not to be a boy or a girl thing, but for them to be able to express that emotion, which they don't necessarily know where it's come from and how to deal with it, is really, really good, because it helps us as a community to understand how hard it is at times, and just to acknowledge that, to acknowledge how difficult it is without parents nearby, without children or not seeing grandchildren, and to be allowed to say that I'm still competent and capable and I can still do all of those things, but I also carry weakness and fragility. And that's honesty, I think, is really, really important. And I hope just doesn't get lost when we get back to whatever the new normal is, because we don't want to get back to a position where people just fall off the edge of the cliff because they've kept it in and kept it in and kept it quiet and then they've gone. And it's not good for business either. But it's particularly not good for families to not be able to talk or articulate or find ways of doing that. So I think for me, just encouraging people to say it's okay, encouraging people to say it's okay to say that my kids aren't doing great, or I'm struggling to spend so much time with them because I'm not sure what I'm doing with them, or I'm not sure why they're being so awful at the moment, But it's okay to have those conversations and for people to, in a sense, let their heart out a little bit more and lower the barriers of professionalism. I can still be really good at what I do, and I'll be even better if you understand what some of my struggles are, because then you'll know why I'm up or down or why this is a particularly bad day. And I think that hopefully that honesty will be really, really good.
Yes, because in some ways the blurring of professional and home life, which has happened over the past 18 months, before you could keep it separate and compartmentalised, and that hasn't been the case. And people have had to say, yes, I'm having struggled with that meeting because, I've got to look after children. So it's going to be certainly interesting, isn't it, looking forward as to whether people can take the sort of the more positive aspects that have arisen out of the situation and see if those will carry on. Mm.
Yes, and I think it's because people have spent time at home and they've travelled less, that obviously causes some kinds of stress and difficulty for some, but also people have really valued that extra time and have said, I'm not sure I want to go back to working the way I did. That, do we have that, the right work-life balance? And it's just really good, isn't it, to look at countries like Scandinavia, which generally does a really good job of work-life balance and how they've managed, and saying, actually, what can we learn from them? How do we need to live that out? What lessons need to be learned so that we can, and companies and workplaces can say, we can take a greater responsibility, not just for productivity, but for their well-being. And so that actually we're looking after the whole person and understanding their work needs. We now have the technology maybe to enable that to happen. But also, I think it's good for business too, that actually if people are, their well-being is better, then ultimately they will be much better able to do their jobs to serve in the workplace. So I think it's a good thing, because then there isn't this kind of bubble that's going to burst. We're much more honest about who we are.
And, on a personal note, after one year on now in Belgium, and despite the constraints of COVID, how are you and your family, you have three children, enjoying living here? Four, sorry.
For us, like so many families, it's been a stretching year. So we thought that we would be toing and froing. We accepted it, that the offer of the post here in early 2020, is it? January 2020.
Feels like a lifetime.
Lifetime ago, when COVID was just some little thing that was going on in China, possibly. So for us, it's been really difficult. The children have not been able to to and fro for holidays, weekends, the things that we thought they'd been able to do. The quarantine has been really difficult, so it's ended up that my wife has spent much more time in the UK looking after the children than we thought, and has been here less. So we've loved the times we've been able to be together. We've made the most of that. It's been a struggle, obviously, because of wider family, not being able to see them. I think we love being here. We love the opportunity to be together a bit more. And looking forward to the fact that hopefully travel restrictions will be lessening. And particularly, we've just loved the way in which people have acknowledged that it's been difficult for us, as it has been for lots of other people who've got loved ones, grandchildren that they've not seen, possibly dying parents that they're not able to be alongside. And I think what we've really appreciated is the way in which the community has acknowledged our struggles, even as we've acknowledged everybody else's struggles, and the way in which I think the community here has bent over backwards to support each other and care for each other and help each other, because we've got each other and we haven't been able to travel, haven't been able to see family. And so I think we feel like very much like a lot of the other families here. Travelling and quarantining has been a bit of a nightmare. I think we spent a fortune on COVID tests, but that's just been the way it is. But we have no regrets about coming here. We love living here. We love being part of the community. And we really I feel privileged really to be able to work amongst a community which has its challenges, but also is really special and it's full of interesting people.
And hopefully you'll have, you know, more time or possibility to enjoy more of the country as well, looking forward.
Yes, and that's one of the things, is that it's one of the dangers, I suppose, because obviously I work weekends and therefore we don't often go away anywhere and travel much. But certainly I think one of the hopes is that with Annie here, hopefully much more in the coming year, then that we'll be able to make the most of days off and begin to explore and have days out, which we've just not done at all.
And also had a better work-life balance as yes. well yourself. Well, thank you, Dominic, for talking to the Bulletin. And it's fascinating hearing about your work. And, you know, please do keep in touch with us and let us know of any activities that the church is involved in. Thank you.